You are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Hey, welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405, where we find out how to make businesses thrive in California. And today we have a couple of very interesting guests who are going to give us some insight into how people who sometimes are hitting the ceiling, hitting the wall, don't understand what's coming, how they might use their values to re-envision that piece that they're calling this substantial reality that blocks them. So I want to welcome Kenton Hyatt and Cheryl DeCiantis, who have created for us a direction in terms of looking at values, and also helped us to use an assessment that will help us find out what our values are. So welcome, Kenton and Cheryl.
Hi.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Well, super. So tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are and what this assessment is about, how you see values.
We actually met. We're a partnership in all ways, actually, but we actually met through doing leadership development work, originally through the Center for Creative Leadership, at the time based in its main offices, North Carolina, Greensboro, North Carolina. But we discovered that all the work that we've done in leadership really is based in fundamental self-awareness. So that's been our direction all the way through, and it's our great passion as well. And we came across values models that were being developed. They've been in development for the last 50 or 75 years, but there was a great deal of work that proceeded through the 60s, 70s, and 80s as cultures were really changing and people were really getting interested in how values were at the bottom of everything. And that's how we got started.
Yep. And we found out that the models that were existing really were lacking, and they had a bias to them that was really quite judgmental. So we kind of asked ourselves, what can we do to have published it, and have been using it nationally and internationally for over a decade now, with a lot of success.
Well, I'm very interested in the whole notion that you've been talking about that what you value creates your reality. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, all of us tend to gravitate toward sort of a world view, and there are a variety of them. None of them are right or wrong or good or bad. They're just different. Some of them are more expansive, and some people have a more narrow focus. Some people like stability and structure, and they really depend on that, and that's very useful and important. Other people love and thrive on change and dynamism. And so there's quite a continuum. There's quite a variety of these different worldviews. But we tend to frame the world through that, our reality, through that worldview. So we look for stimuli. We look for information. We listen to people who correspond to our values and our worldview, and that's how we create and frame our messages. That's how we send information as well, and that's not a bad thing. It's just that when we run into people like ourselves, we tend to form relationships, and we run into people who are different than ourselves, unless we're aware of what's going on, we tend to avoid them, and that could be problematic.
Well, let's talk a little bit about California and business owners in California. California is a very innovative place. People work hard here. There's a lot of recreational opportunities, but people tend to be focused on accomplishing what they want. Now, at the same time, there is this additional culture of, some might call it constraint, others might call it social norms that are put into place very often from Sacramento, and there's this sense of I can't do that because, and so that becomes a very frustrating experience for folks. And one of the things that we're trying to do is to help people re-envision what in fact is happening, to bring to the fore their innovative values and creativity to not to counter so much as to work with, work through toward accomplishing their goals. Does that make any sense?
Oh, it makes so much sense. And one of the things, we've done a great deal of work with creativity, developing creativity over the years. We're both artists as well, by the way. And one of the things about being creative is to not get locked into one's assumptions. We have to be continually questioning our own assumptions. And with regard to how we view, for example, a regulatory environment, how we define that, is actually a great deal of that is the assumptions that we bring to it. We've worked with organizations out in the field where regulators meet up with people who are doing a job of work within an organizational context, and we can find that the quality of the relationship and the assumptions that each of the parties bring to it can make the outcome of that interaction entirely different. It can be a total failure or it can be a great win-win. And it's amazing how much what we think of as the regulatory environment can be conditioned by the reality of it, can be conditioned by what attitudes we bring to the work that we're doing, how we're planning to work within the rule of law, where the wiggle room is, because there's always wiggle room with regard to the latitude of how things can be interpreted on the ground.
Well, a lot of it begins with finding out what our habitual thinking is about. How are we regulating ourselves, in a sense, so that we can look at our habits, look at our relationships, and actually then change the narrative, change the story about how we're describing our situations and the challenges that we're working with. And when we found, especially in terms of regulation, when people develop collaborative relationships with their regulators, they're really creating opportunities to overcome challenges and what would be limitations and obstacles, but they've redefined them. And so then they actually end up with a partner, whereas before they would have an adversary. And the difference can be absolutely incredible, and it turns out to be immediately financially amazing as well.
Well, does that involve a change in either the regulatory personnel or the business people who feel like they're being constrained? Does that involve some sort of change that might imply that we've given in, we've lost?
Well, it might because some people do just simply say, well, there's nothing I can do about this, and we're not lobbyists or regulators or legislators or anything, and so we're not experts on the law. But what we are good at and what we work at it with is, no matter who you're working with, you can develop a collaborative relationship with, say, a given project manager working in the field or a small business person. They're going to have to interface with some sort of regulator. And it matters a great deal about how they approach those people and how they develop their relationships, how much information they share, what are the assumptions going in, so that they can give themselves an opportunity to discover what latitude there already is. It may be that regulations also need to be changed or redefined or whatever, but right now we're looking at, well, what have you got to work with and who are you working with? Let's start there, because that's the reality.
We're going to put on a conference either in the latter part of November, early December. We're making a decision about the date this week. And what our intention is to bring 25, 30 business owners together and to have the first half of the three-hour session focused on maybe 10 minutes from HR perspective, from a tax perspective, from a legal perspective, environmental perspective, and an IT perspective, and let each of those presenters talk about what, in fact, is coming down the pike, sometimes from Sacramento, sometimes from the Coastal Commission, from various regulatory bodies, what, in fact, is coming at businesses in the next 5 years. After that, we want to take a little pause and then make a short speech, which says, look, folks, this is what's coming, this is reality, you have a choice. You can leave, and if you want to leave, here's the telephone number of the governor of Texas. I grew up in Texas. I'm sure he'll take your call. And their phone's right there outside the door. If you want to leave the conference now, feel free to use the phone. On the other hand, if you choose to stay, like the clients that work with us, we are here. We don't have the answers, but we are here to help you in the process of being creative, innovative, and coming up with ways to thrive, because our clients have decided to stay here and to learn how to thrive and to meet the challenge. But there's one rule. No more whining.
Well, that's good.
That's a great thing. What we might suggest replacing that no more whining rule with, I mean, if somebody needs to know what they should be doing instead, ask more questions.
Okay.
Foster dialogue. Find out what's really in the environment around you. Ask questions of your own people. Gallup just put out a really interesting, the Gallup organization just put out a really interesting report on what millennials want in the workplace and in other life domains. One of the things that their research overturned was the assumption that millennials just want to be coddled. In fact, what engaged millennials attribute their engagement to in the workplace is that they have a boss that lets them know what they should be doing and holds them to it.
Uh-huh.
So they're actually looking for feedback, which is one of the things when you're thinking about something like that, it puts a responsibility on the employee to live up to the expectations. But it also puts a responsibility on the manager to find out, to keep in communication, to make sure that communication is clear, to be dependent, be able to be dependent on by the employee, to be present. So that's one of the aspects of dialogue as well, that I can't set somebody out there and assume that everything's going to go the way I think it should or I said once it should. We have to keep conversations going constantly, and asking questions is one of the best ways to do it.
Well, we have found that relationship skills, like feedback, are the most highly identified needs in organizational values and individual teams and executive development work as well, and the areas in which skills are lacking the most. So when Cheryl mentioned feedback as an example, we find that that's a word that makes people duck under the desk because they don't know how to do it well. Somebody stops by your office and says, oh, I'd like to give you a little feedback. It's like, oh, my gosh, where can I hide? Because it's going to hurt. And that already tells us that somebody's doing that incorrectly. That's not how it's supposed to work. But in order to make it work right, those people in the conference, for example, who you make the invitation to stay or leave, before they can make that decision, they have to find out who they are first. They have to find out what's important for them first. And that's the kind of work that we do, is to say, all right, let's take a few minutes and talk about what your priorities are, what do you really want to have happen, what makes you tick, what's most important for you. And once we find that out and get that sort of articulated, then we can move forward, because people might want innovation. They might want actually adaptive innovation and not really, you know, they want to bring the house down. They want to change what's there. That's fine. We can work with that. Other people say, no, we really want to change the game entirely. We want something entirely new. That's a bigger challenge, but that's also possible. Both of those approaches trigger different kinds of dynamics, but we have to find out who they are first and what their priorities are before you can just launch into deciding whether you want to stay or go.
That's interesting. Now, I'm wondering if to what degree language and values influence each other, the use of the words that we have, because when you speak to me of feedback, in my mind, I immediately hear accountability. And management, ownership, tends to love accountability, but likewise, they don't know how to do it. And I wonder if accountability and feedback are in the same area.
Oh, absolutely, because accountability and responsibility, both of those words kind of, they parallel each other, maybe even synonyms in some people's minds, but they work very much the same way. But there's a reciprocality to it. That is, we are responsible and accountable for our work, we're also accountable not for just doing the work, but for reporting it, for explaining it, for identifying what it was. And managers oftentimes lack the skills to be able to say, well, that's not exactly what I meant. So when you're doing such and such behavior, the impact is actually an unintended consequence. So that kind of a dialogue is the skills to hold it are really what's missing. It isn't that people don't want to be accountable. They don't know how to make the dialogue work so that accountability can be achieved.
Right. Now, I want to pick up on the whole notion of millennials after the break that we have in a little bit. But talk to me a little bit more about how companies are, how do they make this choice whether to stay or to leave? Now, I know that in California, sometimes we tell ourselves horror stories. I don't know whether it's for enjoyment or threat, but we talk about everybody leaving, which is really not true. The economy in California is growing. We have people moving here with great innovation. We do have some outflow of businesses, but it's not anywhere near what some people talk about. So how do we help companies to dig down and to find out what their real values are, what their real intent is?
Well, there are several ways, but sort of doing a cultural inventory is a really good way to start. So that an organization, no matter how large or small it might be, takes a few moments or a little while to find out, to take stock. What are our talents? What are our strengths? What do we have to offer in terms of our mission and objectives? And given the context then of the California environment, you know, what might be the prospects, you know, be? And then that kind of calculus will then allow people to make an informed decision about, say, staying or leaving. But California is an incredibly rich and diverse and very large economy and state. So there are tremendous opportunities in California. And that's been the case for 100 years or more. And it's probably not going to change very, very quickly, even in spite of regulations.
Right. Well, I think that's the recovery from the kind of initial response to being told no, or you can't, or here are the edges that you can't get out of. Now, I'm wondering if, in the same way that we connected the word feedback to accountability and responsibility, the notion about what does a company bring and what are the threats that they have, does that have anything to do with a SWOT analysis?
That's a great tool, sure.
It's a wonderful tool. But if we go back to feedback for a moment, being about accountability, there's something else about feedback that is probably underlies that. And before we can really get to mutual accountability, we have to be objective in looking at the reality of a situation about what is expected, why is it expected, what's driving the accountability. Because if we look at what we really want as an outcome, we may decide that we have given ourselves arbitrary limits. That's one thing. So is the feedback targeted in the right direction that's really going to get us to go where we want to go? But the other thing underneath it, too, is that feedback is not necessarily meant, it's not meant to be always negatively judgmental. It's meant to be an objective evaluation so that it's a safe process to undergo, but it also requires that a man or someone giving feedback is objective about what the needs are and what the behaviors are, for example, and the person who's receiving the feedback is also being asked to be objective about how he or she is adding up to what's demanded by the situation. So in the same way that people who own businesses in California may want to take a step back and look as objectively as they can about what's really out there. What can they affect and what can they not affect? And a lot of times we're making the assumption that we're more powerless than in fact we truly are. Because there are so many tools available to us now to be networking, asking questions, communicating, influencing, changing regulations as things go on in an objective and realistic way.
So what I'm hearing is that in terms of the relationship with the employee, this accountability, the feedback. Part of that is being driven by what is our vision, where are we going, what is it that we want to accomplish, and compare that to the clear data that we all agree upon is reliable data. I mean, that to me is the objectivity. That is that what you're talking about?
Right, because you have to have a handle on or an identification of both of those before you can decide on a strategy about what you're going to do. And in fact, what your initial kind of example of the invitation to stay or leave is a strategic decision. So before you can, you know, lots of times we're in organizations, we find people sort of guilty of the ready, shoot, aim kind of approach, where they just react without having enough data and really understanding who they are and where they are, you know, what resources they've actually got, who's sitting at, you know, at the desks in their offices. Lots of times, you know, we get hired for specific things, but people oftentimes have vast amounts of talents and resources that are not tapped into, and they don't share them because, frankly, nobody asks, nobody knows what they are, and nobody asks. Creating a different kind of organizational culture and climate can oftentimes create remarkable contribution opportunities from the people who are already at work.
Yes, and I've found that to be so true. Many businesses under $50 million were founded by very creative people, but what they did when they went out to hire is they hired assistants in the various areas of responsibility. And what I mean by that is those assistants, while they might have been very creative and very highly productive people, they lined up every day outside the boss's office to find out what to do next. And that limits the business. It limits the contribution of the employee. And changing that culture from an owner-centric business to one where the business culture expects the managers in the various areas to make qualified, responsible decisions in a collaborative sense, rather than expecting that one founder to be omnicompetent in all the varieties of responsibilities of the business, which have become very complicated in today's world. So I agree with you that helping that company change their culture very often releases 50% of that undiscovered dark matter, that dark responsibility and stark capability that was there all the time.
Right, right. You know, people cannot just simply begin to collaborate. You know, that's a risky undertaking. It needs to be developed, and you can't start there. It starts way back, and we were talking about values earlier. In our work, we've seen this over and over again. No matter what the context, no matter what the size of the organization or who's involved, if the relationships don't begin with respect, if they don't start sharing information, if there's not questioning and sharing information, listening, which builds trust, then collaboration isn't simply going to be a nice word. It'll be a word on the poster on the wall. We'll all look at it and say, yeah, we you know, that's our goal, but it'll never happen. It takes work to get there. It doesn't happen immediately, but it can clearly happen.
Right. To me, it takes a commitment, it takes a vision, and then it takes some traction to be able to make that happen over
right.
time. This is wonderful, wonderful conversation. I really enjoy this, and I think this is going to be very helpful to businesses in California who are looking to thrive in the next 5 to 10 years. And I want to take a short break here. Can you guys stick around and talk with us some more?
Sure. We'd love to.
Yeah. All right. So, and when we get back, let's focus on the millennials and how millennials can contribute to businesses and help them thrive in California.
Does your company need more than basic financial transactions? Are you holding your business back with your entry-level accounting software? When your business starts to grow, and it will, you'll need more security, features, and functionality. Well, let me introduce you to Gravity Software. Gravity Software's online accounting solution is written on the Microsoft CRM platform. No more islands of information. Financials and CRM are fully integrated and in the cloud. Gravity's goal is to fill the gap between entry-level accounting software like QuickBooks and complex and expensive enterprise applications. Gravity Software, simply innovative business management. Learn more at go-gravity.com.
Hi, it's time for another tip from Sandler Training. Traditional sales training teaches techniques on how to eliminate stalls and objections. Some are fancy sales moves, while others are programmed responses. Sales is a conversation, and I don't know how you can memorize every possible response for every sales situation. Also, the prospect has usually heard these responses before and has been turned off by some fancy sales move. When you really think about it, the only person qualified to address the stall or objection is the prospect. Ask the right questions, and you will eliminate stalls and objections. And that's another tip from Sandler Training, finding power through reinforcement.
And now back to Will and his guests.
Well, we've been having a fascinating conversation with Kenton Hyatt and Cheryl DeSiantis, who have been working for years on helping companies identify their values, identify what sorts of resources they have, often undiscovered resources in terms of the values component that exists in companies. And I want to turn our conversation now to looking at millennials and what we can discover when we think about millennials and the values that they bring to the marketplace, rather than the disruption or the limitation or the obstacle. So let's talk a little bit about that, Kenton and Cheryl.
Well, we actually just have been looking at this very carefully with, I think I mentioned that Gallup has just put out a really interesting report on research report on millennials. And Gallup really have an extremely useful concept that they call engagement at work. And the results of engagement, where employees feel that they're recognized, that someone's watching out for them, that the work they do matters, it results in more productivity, it results in better safety records, less happens that's not supposed to happen. Absenteeism is substantially reduced when employees are engaged. And customer ratings are better, and companies are more profitable. So it's really fascinating to be looking at what's going on with that. And to introduce an important negative into the conversation, Gallup has found that only 29% of millennials are engaged at work. There are a lot of people that are disengaged at work in these days, and there are a lot of reasons for it. But they talk a lot about, they look very carefully at what does engage those millennials who are engaged at work. Yeah. And that was where they overturned a very popular assumption out there that millennials want to feel that they're going to be cosseted, that they're going to get rewards that they don't necessarily attach directly to their meeting expectations at work. And I think that they sort of put a pin in that particular little assumptive balloon with regard to what engaged millennials are really looking for. And one of the main things that they're really looking for is communication with a boss, feedback, and clear expectations. So those are not really hard targets. If we prioritize those as targets, that's not really hard to do. And, of course, what millennials bring is an entirely different worldview. I mean, they're the first digital generation. Everything is different for them. So that to the degree to which, I mean, we have to bring millennials into the workforce, whether they're in control of it, we're in control of it, we're all in control of it. But one of the interesting things that Gallup points out, too, is they estimate that millennial turnover due to disengagement costs the U.S. economy $30.5 billion annually. So there's a lot that can be done to turn around the basic economy by really understanding what we can do to engage people as part of our large, diverse workforce in this country. Millennials are part of that incredible diversity.
Right, and what we discovered a couple of weeks ago in an interview here on The Pilgrim on the 405 with Chip Espinosa. You know Chip and his work?
We, no. We looked at that wonderful, the things that he had to say were just great.
Yes, and what he said, and his books will bear it out in terms of research, is that the problem is not with the millennials. The problem is with expectations from the baby boomer or Generation X managers.
Exactly right.
Yep.
And where the millennials could make their greatest contribution, there was flexibility in the management in terms of what was expected.
So senior leaders need to realize they're going to have to take some risks. What they feel like, it might feel like risk-taking, but they're going to have to learn some new things. And learning something new assumes, one, that you don't know it. And people who are comfortable with power kind of think they've got all the answers. If you've got all the answers, you can't learn anything. And you're probably not open to very much flexibility. And when working with another cultural kind of dynamic and identity like the millennials bring in, that requires people to become more flexible, to take a look at their old behaviors and say, well, wait a minute, maybe what I've been doing isn't appropriate anymore. Maybe I need to learn how to behave differently. It doesn't mean I have to change my identity or anything like that, but there are different ways of behaving. And so the challenges that we're facing require the engagement of everybody, not just pointing a finger at millennials and saying, oh, there's the problem. No, the problem is the entire organizational culture or the entire team culture is not integrating the diversity that it's actually got.
And it seems to me that what happens very often is that when there is a problem, i.e. we're not getting what we want from our business, then the first step is to start blaming, and we can certainly see some of that in our political conversation today. If they would just do something different, it would be all right.
Yeah.
How do we and how do we get them to do different things? Which very often in the management courses that I teach, that very often is the first thing that a manager will say when they enter into my program is, tell me, I want to learn how to get my people to do what I tell them to do.
Right. Yes, we hear that all the time.
And I have to tell them, well, let's begin with the reality you can't.
Exactly, yeah.
And if you're not getting what you want from your business, then by definition, you're going to have to change what you're doing. Because if you do the same thing next week that you did last week, you're not going to expect different results, are you?
You're pretty much going to get the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and besides that, people are being paid to do what they did last week. You just reinforced the last week's behavior unless you go to them and say, okay, wait a minute, this isn't working. We're leaving a lot of money on the table here. Let's figure out a different way of cracking this nut.
Yes.
And there are lots of the wonderful thing is that there are actually a lot of different opportunities. There's a lot of latitude in solving these problems, but they're very specific to the situation. So what we found is that it really does take sort of a customized contextual approach. What's going on for this group of people with these particular constraints, with this group of talents or whatever they've got to work? Find out, let's start there so that they can feel like this isn't just kind of an off-the-shelf kind of approach that one size fits all, but it really is tailored for them, and they're being listened to.
And I think one of the items that the Gallup poll mentioned was that managers who meet regularly and frequently, and my way of thinking, that means at least once a week, with employees, they're more likely to find that those employees are engaged all across the board, generationally.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. And one of the wonderful things about California is it's such a crucible for diversity, and generally, and millennials being part of that diversity. But then we also have to understand, too, that within any human community, and that includes, for example, anything that we can label, there are ranges of cognitive, personality preferences, all kinds of things within even those categories. So that one person who fits within the millennial age grouping may have a very different requirement for how he or she is rewarded at work than another person who fits the same demographic. And the only way to find out the difference is for managers to be proactive and to ask and to keep that communication open.
Big word, isn't it, to be proactive, when what we're really talking about is ask the question, what do you want?
That's right.
Because you won't find out if you don't ask.
Right,
you
know? That's right.
Asking good questions is one of the premier managerial skills, and it has been for 100 years, and it's probably not going to change ever.
Movement toward consultative selling, which means that the salesperson is really there to ask questions.
Yes.
To find out what the prospect, what the other human being, what issues they have, what are their problems, what are their goals, where do they want to go that they're not getting right now, and is there a way that I can help them? And I wonder if there's, I haven't seen it, but I wonder if there's an equal shift toward consultative management.
I think there is. I think it's a little bit lagging because people tend to do what they've always done. And oftentimes managers get saddled with the idea, it's a false assumption, that they have to have all the answers. And that they're weak somehow, they appear weak, if they don't have them. So oftentimes people will make things up so that they can sound competent and articulate. But in fact, you know, it's not just meeting often that's the trick. Because if we sit down and meet the first time, we're all going to look at each other and feel kind of uncomfortable about it. So it has to become part of the organizational culture. And in those meetings, the flow of information of what's happening for you and how do we work with it, those kinds of questions and responses, that reciprocal kind of exchange of information has to become routine. So it doesn't feel false and it doesn't feel inauthentic, and so people begin to trust the manager is really serious when he or she says, how's it going? It's not just a platitude. They really want to know.
Yes, and these conversations, too, are not to be understood as specifically an evaluation, either. They should be independent from evaluation. For example, if a company is still doing performance reviews, and a lot of them are letting them go at this point, or completely redefining them, it should be away from a judgmental status for the meeting and more of an informational exchange. But a different thing, one of the things that I think that some of the remarks that you made in the last 2 minutes really point up to the responsibility of the manager toward the employee as well, to be proactive in finding out what's going on. Also, I think that this is something that's reflected in some of the really interesting work that for example, Gallup has done in the past and that we've encountered quite a great deal, is that an employee also needs for a manager to be, particularly in an organization that has more than one or two layers of involvement in a hierarchical way, that their manager is also going to be responsible for kind of interpreting what's coming down from the overall goals of the organization, the vision of the organization, the demands of senior leadership, that the manager is going to be a kind of osmotic barrier between what's above and what's below and also what's over to the side, and so the lateral influences, that people can depend upon their managers to be responsible for defining how their own span of authority, if you like, and the people that work within it are what they have to do for themselves in order to live up to and fulfill the organizational goals in the way that they do most efficiently, that they're making the greatest contribution, that they're also communicating information, and they're also to some degree protected from the consequences that a manager may have to take on him or herself when interpreting between the caveats of upper management and the needs of the organization to how is this really going to work for the people that I'm concerned with and that are concerned with me and are what we're contributing to the organization.
Yes, and what I found is that it begins at the top. If the owner in an owner-centric business believes that owner needs to have all the answers, and that he or she really knows where the business is going, and maybe they're the only one who knows where the business is going. They haven't really shared the vision. Then they wind up in that spot where, and I've seen it happen, where because the business has really outgrown the operating system of the business, that all that pressure for that owner-centric owner drives them crazy, literally drives them crazy to do strange things like wind up with extramarital affairs and embezzling and things like that, simply because they were so isolated and they weren't in their own eyes, weren't competent. Well, so we were talking about how a business owner, if he's allowed the owner-centric model of the operating system, which puts the business owner at the center and the one who's got to make all the decisions and bear all the responsibility, that gets cascaded down throughout the organization. Would you agree?
Very much so. And the entire culture becomes kind of a familial dynamic. And that's almost a necessity for startups and small businesses. But as soon as a business starts to grow, then they're going to find that they're going to start needing to move into more of a managerial, hierarchical, and more dynamic kind of idea. So overall, what happens is people need to take risks. They need to learn how to change. We've often held that if an organization or a business doesn't learn how to reinvent itself, eventually it won't continue. It'll cease to exist. Everybody, even individuals, we continually need to cycle into our foundation and then rebuild what we're doing. And in so doing, that manager as center or manager as father or mother, if you will, needs to learn to let go. And it can be a little threatening and risky, but it's a necessary growth pattern.
Right. And what I have found is Gino Wickman's work called Traction and the Entrepreneurial Operating System, it's a very exciting and helpful template, a tool for changing the operating system of the business from that owner-centric, founder-centered to one where there's much more collaboration and much more responsibility, and it's a system for giving that kind of feedback all the way through the organization, because it begins with sharing the vision, a clear vision, with the entire organization, and sometimes even to the vendors.
Oh, absolutely.
Right, yes. Absolutely, yes. When we do organizational alignment, values alignment, then we align the values of the organization, not from the top down, but just that run all the way through. We do an assessment of the entire organization. And that's sort of the long haul work, but it really is what really matters. It really it helps people to all get on the same page. And then you don't get that senior leadership disconnect that often happens, especially in larger organizations.
Yes. And the sharing the vision is not a one-way street. You know, it's meant to originate in many organizations still at the top, but that isn't necessarily a requirement, and in a lot of cases it's going to be less and less so. But what it does have to be is it has to be redefined in the terms, through the terms and values of every single participant in the organization, so that they're living their vision, and then there has to be a dialogue so that that's mutually understood. Here's how I see it, here's how you see it, what's the overlap? How are we going to participate and behave so that we know we're really operating in alignment with a shared vision that we really know is shared because we really know what it means?
Absolutely. And when I've worked with companies implementing the entrepreneurial operating system, it's interesting that there are times when part of the exercise in the second full-day meeting is to begin to talk about values, and you generate the values through some exercises where everybody contributes. And it's interesting that from time to time, an owner will say to me, we don't really need to spend a lot of time on because I've already got the values of the company.
Yes, that's very common.
Yeah. You think you've got the values.
And as we begin to move through where there are these shared values and this common vision for why the company's there, where it's going, that then then you spoke about reviews. Reviews can have to do, can be, you can begin to use the values to help in your reviews as well as in your quarterly conversations with the entire company about where we're going and why we're going. Here's our values and this is why we're doing it. And then when we hire, we're not only looking for people who want to do the job and have the capability, but also people who share the values of the company.
Yes. And here's a little freebie for people. If they separate out the review from the development, and they have two different conversations, so one time they're saying, here's what where you're going to go, here's how you're going to develop in your position and who you are as a person and your values and all of that kind of stuff. And in another conversation, they say, here's what you've done, and here's here are the strengths, and here's the great part, here are the limitations, and here are the rewards for it. So that those are separate, and they're not conflated. They'll find out that both of those will be much more successful.
Now, let's talk a little bit about where we started in our conversation this morning. The focus of the Pilgrim on the 405 is to help businesses in California thrive. To take that seriously and to see the resources that you, Kenton and Cheryl, bring, what would be a way to pull your resources into helping businesses in California thrive?
Well, one of the things that we're trying to do in our work is to, we consult and teach directly, but we're really trying to get a values attitude out there and develop skills in communities and businesses and practitioners. So we provide a lot of resources with regard to that. But one of the things, too, that is so important about values, and you really were on about something when the values discussion becomes part of that regular meeting that we have with everyone in the organization, because values are watchwords. If we know that we value feedback, we know that we value collaboration, we know that we value customer value, if everyone understands mutually what those values mean for themselves and for the organization, it drives the decisions and the choices they make every day, and they don't have to be told by a manager exactly what to do. So that's one of the ways that this works. Companies can undergo values alignment meetings. They can work with the values model and so forth.
We actually have our own objective is to help people internalize their own processes, identify them, and then internalize them. We train people and get them set up so they're not dependent on external consultants, that it becomes an internal cultural process that they own and that they regulate. Because we find that the more people are dependent on external consultants, the more difficulties you run into, and then the less senior leadership buy-in and support you actually get. So our mode of working is to try to help people get things set up and then train the trainer, if you will, and step away as quickly as we can.
Can we do that in conference mode here with 25, 30 business owners? Does it have to be just one business at a time? Can there be a group of businesses working together?
I think people working together, one of the wonderful things about people working together in those kinds of conference situations is you get a lot of cross-fertilization of experience and ideas, and that's just fun. That's really informing and very useful. So yes, you can get a lot done in that kind of a setting. You can't go as deep. And so that's the trade-off, is when you're working with an intact group, then you go deeper into their individual issues. You have more time. And when you have a diverse group, then you have a broader spectrum to work with. You can cover a wider range of issues.
Yes. And with a diverse group, however, it's really good to get multiple perspectives, that diversity again, on what values are, how they work, how a model can be generally applied. And a diverse group that learns the basics of values dynamics can go away and actually start applying them instantly.
Well, that's excellent, and I'm just dreaming out loud and wondering if it might be worthwhile to begin to to put together a conference where we would put 20 or 30 people in a room and spend the day looking at some of these issues and helping businesses, actually doing the challenge to help businesses thrive in California.
Yeah.
Yes, we do that kind of thing, and it's a lot of fun. It's really a lot of fun.
It is. And we think that when you're having fun and doing your work, then you know that the outcomes are usually pretty good.
Excellent. Well, it's been wonderful talking with you and wonderful getting to know you more. If someone listening to this, one of our listeners wanted to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Go to our website, which is kairios.com, and we'll spell that for you. It's kairios.com. There are some resources there, and there's a way to get in contact with us. And we'd welcome any questions. We really try to give people lots of information, but that's the easiest and best way to get in touch with us. And also to get linked up with the online survey if people are interested in learning more about that as well.
Excellent. Well, this has been wonderful, and I thoroughly believe this is just the beginning of a longer-term conversation and perhaps even some conferences here in Southern California to help businesses thrive. So thank you very much, Cheryl and Kenton, for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Would just be great.
Thanks a lot.
We've enjoyed it a lot.
Well, and here we are with the Pilgrim on the 405 looking out over boundaries of California into Arizona to find resources that will help businesses in California thrive, which is what we are aimed at doing. So I encourage you to join us in looking around, asking the right questions to help businesses in California thrive.
Listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. To hear more of the programs in this podcast, go to www.willcrist.com.